Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Paul, we now know more about the recent police shooting of Harry Smith. The police released a tape of the 911 call in that incident. What can you tell us about that?
That particular tape, the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals has been under some, some pressure over the past week or two to release why it reached its decision not to pursue the officers in the shooting. The tape was released. The tape, all along, the man's son has said he told the police that he was armed with a BB gun, that he might want to kill himself
the
by
man
cop,
shot,
commit
yeah.
suicide. That's correct. There was no mention of a BB gun anywhere on the 911 tape. There was a mention that he might try to commit suicide by cop, if you will. So we know that that's out there. We also have more details, I think, on the actual shooting. They released the Special Prosecution Office, released the letter summarizing the findings of why they reached the conclusion they did not to pursue the officers. It sounds like they used non-lethal means to no effect. And finally, at the very end, when they thought they were facing a firearm, a pistol, they fired to take him down. That's pretty much what we know now.
It seemed to me it was also an interesting example of eyewitness testimony when you yourself are the eyewitness and you remember erroneously. I guess that's what I'm willing to assume about the 911 caller who remembered the call erroneously.
I think the worst witnesses in the world are eyewitnesses. The people who were closest to it often don't get it right. We have several cases of that just in this state, mm-hmm. Where you have people who see something, they're positive. That's what they hear something, they're positive. It didn't happen that way.
Okay, Steve, you want to get
in? It's possible that Mr. Smith's son may have mentioned something to the police as they arrived on the scene. He may have said something that's
conflated
a BB.
It.
Perhaps that may have happened there. We have to give him that possibility too. But as you say, sometimes the worst witnesses are the ones who are right there in terms of getting things accurate. I can't imagine the amount of stress for all involved, family members, police officers. It's a life and death situation, and there are so many things that are running through one's mind. I can only imagine at a moment like that, to keep everything straight would be very difficult to do.
And the other thing too, I think you have to consider is even if they were all apprised that he has a BB gun. When they look at, they're going to have to make the instant decision when they're facing that. Is that a BB gun? Mm-hmm. Is that a BB gun? Is that a real gun? They're going to have to react to the threat, as they say in the release. They react to the threat that's in front of them. They really can't take somebody's word. Yeah, it's a BB gun.
Police put out a photograph with the two, the BB gun and the weapon, right. An actual gun, and you can't tell apart. And again, a stressful situation. Do you want to rely on that bit of information when it's you who may be on the receiving end of a gun or a BB gun? That's a tough position to be put in.
Yeah, we don't want to be in that position.
No.
Tim Bradner, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar visits Alaska. Where did he go? What did he see? What did he say?
This was his fourth, and he said his final, probably his, maybe his final visit here to the state.
Just notice that I'm retiring. I don't have much faith in the election.
He was primarily here to look at the National Petroleum Reserve in the Arctic, and he flew over it. He went and visited several villages up north. He stayed in the camp of former Mayor Edward Eda of the North Slope Barrel. The primary product of that came out of it, though, was an announcement that they had picked a preferred alternative for the management plan of the NPRA that puts half of it into a protected status. And that's become very controversial because it only opens half of it to oil development and it conserves the other half. So, if you're an environmental group, you're happy with what he did. If you're the state of Alaska oil industry, you're unhappy with it. Very interesting to me that that minutes after that press release came out, just within 2 minutes, press releases from the Audubon Society and the Wilderness Society were out commending the decision. I mean, obviously they'd been briefed in advance on this and had pre-prepared the press releases.
How much longer did it take for the denunciatory press releases?
Well, very interesting. I talked later to Commissioner Dan Sullivan of the state, and he said that the state had had no advance warning of this. They didn't even know the decision on a preferred alternative was coming today. Mm-hmm. So they took it really as sort of a wrap by the Interior Department.
Okay. And let's stick with you, Tim. Tell us about Shell's delayed drilling, which Salazar also discussed. What's Shell saying, and what Salazar have to
well,
say?
Well, when he was talking last week in a press conference, he took the opportunity to sort of scold Shell a little bit. Shell, for a long time, had said the ice conditions were very difficult, and that was the delay that why they were coming to the Arctic. Well, the waters are open now because the secretary flew out over the ocean in the areas where Shell wants to drill are wide open. The problem Shell now has, and it's really hard to understand this, there's a barge that they need to have up there. It's part of the regulatory requirements to have this special spill containment barge, and it's not finished yet, whether it's built, but it's just not cleared with its inspections. And it's just mystifying to people why that is the case. The Interior Secretary said that he inferred that Shell should have been better prepared and more on top of this thing. I get the feeling that there may be other issues going on here, maybe some special problems with the barge or special requirements by the government. Who knows? In any event, the barge is not finished
yet. If I might interrupt you, what is Shell saying?
They're saying the barge is not finished yet.
But when explaining the why of it.
A lot of work done on the barge, and just that the inspections are not complete yet is what they're saying. They're not really elaborating much on the details. I think, after this thing is completed, we'll probably get a fuller story. But the bottom line is the barge is still in Seattle. It takes 14 to 18 days to get it to the Arctic. Shell can't drill until the barge is there. So it just keeps pushing the clock back further. And they have to have their drilling done and be out of there by... in the case of the Chukchi Sea, they have to finish their wells down to the hydrocarbon zone by September 21.
And regulation?
Yeah. By regulation. Now, in the Beaufort Sea, where they also want to drill, they have later to go. They have to be totally out of the Arctic by October, the end of October. But in any event, they can still do a lot of work. But the longer it takes to get this barge finished, it just keeps pushing the whole thing.
And when would the season begin next year?
Well, the season in the Arctic begins when the ice melts and goes out, and usually that's the end of July, early August. This year was unusually late, but Shell's later. It's a tough deal. That company has $4.5 billion at stake on this, and they've had one delay and one problem after another. And it's a lot of it is just kind of bad luck. But
It's interesting to me that you don't hear them. Particularly, or I haven't heard much of their complaining about the government. I mean, they've commented on the government's policies, but they're not saying, well, the government's not letting us do this, or in the way that we've heard it.
Well, they're still in the position where they have to get the government's permission to do things, so I think they're being cautious in what they say. But I think they also realize that this is kind of a new arena in terms of the whole environmental protection. Post-Gulf of Mexico blowout, we have a whole new ball game in terms of protections and rules and things like that. And that's really what's probably driving a lot of the delay.
Steve, Tim referred earlier to Senator Murkowski, or rather the Obama administration's NPRA decision and Senator Murkowski's comments on it. She wasn't upset. She wasn't happy at all with what the administration's doing. Can you tell us more?
Well, she felt that more of the NPRA should have been opened up for development. As Tim mentioned, it's about 23 million acres in size. The federal government is recommending that about 11.8 million of those acres be developed. Off limits is the Tushapuck Lake area, which is an important breeding ground for a lot of waterfowl. Also, there are areas that have been set aside because they're important feeding and calving areas for, I don't know if a calving areas for caribou, but certainly caribou do indeed depend on these areas. So those have been set aside. They're important for subsistence hunters. So they took that into consideration. They tried to find this balance. Senator Murkowski, she's upset. She just feels that, you know, this is an energy issue. This is a jobs issue. More of this thing should have been opened up for development to create more jobs and create more energy. The federal government, the Obama administration, feels that this is a very well-balanced plan. Environmentalists have come out, as Tim said, and say, oh, yeah, they struck the right balance and they did the right thing, which is really pretty amazing in this case as well, because usually when the federal government opens up something for development, pro-developers say they didn't go far enough, and the environmentalists said it goes too far. So they actually made one side happy anyway, so that's pretty miraculous in my opinion. But that's kind of what it is. They've struck this, at least they've tried to strike this balance, and final approval of this plan, this development plan, is expected in December. So we'll see if anything changes between now and then.
Anything to add here, Tim, from what you just heard?
Oh, just that one of the major issues in this plan is the idea of a pipeline corridor. Mm-hmm. If Shell finds oil in the Chukchi Sea, how do they get it to the pipeline? So you need a pipeline across NPRA. And the state administration and others would like there to have been a defined corridor within this plan, and there wasn't one. But the secretary pointed out that there's nothing in the plan that precludes a pipeline application. When that is made, they'll look at it, and they'll have to go through the NEPA process and all that.
And for our viewers, how long would that pipeline be?
It would be a long pipeline, several hundred miles. I hear just the number 400 miles comes into my mind, and it'd be a huge project. Mm-hmm. It would be a major. It would be equally, think of half of Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Actually, that is a great metaphor for discussion. Yeah.
I think that Senator Begich's largest concern with this whole process was that the place where it would come ashore from the Arctic Ocean or the North is pretty much precluded in this pipeline corridor business. So it's going to have a real effect on what they do and how they do it, I guess, in the future.
Paul, let's stick with you. The Mat-Su Borough again struggles with the question, what to do with the free ferry? Are we any closer to a resolution of the vexing ferry question?
No, I think there's a business opening up for water skiing up and down Kinnegar. This is one of those things, I swear to you, this is government at its absolute finest. We have, the Navy has an experimental craft.
This is local
craft.
Government, which is supposed to be governing closest to the people.
The federal government is in on this too. The Defense Department decides, well, what we'll do is we'll let the Navy have this experimental $80 million boat, which we have named the Susitna, which we probably ought to call the lead weight. It basically is being stored now in Kent. They gave it to the Mat-Su Borough. They got done with it. They did it. It's an assault. You can imagine. It's an assault ferry. I assume you put your tanks and your Corvette on there and you rush across. I don't know how it works. It only carries 20 vehicles. I mean, it's not like this thing is going to be...
you have to make room for the tanks.
A key part of the transportation system up here. So it sits now in Ketchikan, where we've, since April, the Mat-Su Borough has paid $300,000 in rental fees and is racking it up at $70,000 a month. What are we going to do with the ferry, they keep asking themselves. Well, they can rent it, they can lease it, they can give it away. Nobody really wants it. They want to give it away to the state ferry system, but it only carries 20 vehicles. The state has no tanks that we're
aware
of.
In this economy, it'd be hard to sell.
Well, who are you going to sell it to? Right. I mean, it's a specialized kind of vehicle. There's some talk, well, we can just run it up on the beach. No, the maker says that's not a good idea. Well, we can run it up into the mud. Well, that's probably not a good idea.
Could crack
either.
The hull. Yeah.
So now they're trying to figure a way to get it back to Point McKenzie and either put it in dry dock, do something with it, because it's eating them out of house and home. It is an incredible. And if free things cost this much, I'm surprised that anything's free.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I know that one of the issues, this is going back to the Begich administration when he was mayor. He didn't agree to having this ferry, if I remember correctly, land here, and no dock was built.
Or there.
That's the key here. Now, this is the Mat-Su Borough that has built the ferry, ordered the ferry, had the ferry built. They don't have a dock for it either. So
it would cost $30 million to build docks on both sides. $30 million.
So, Paul, does the Democrat who's involved here get the right to say, I told you so?
No, he gets blamed.
Because he didn't build the one dock.
That's exactly right. If he'd have led the way, we would have been there.
I see. Okay, Tim, lawmakers and others are exploring the possibility of converting North Slope gas to electricity and sending that electricity or power all over interior and south central Alaska. What are the basics? What are the prospects?
Well, this is, you know, this idea of if you can't have a gas pipeline, why not generate power with the gas and build a long distance transmission line and build it down to Fairbanks and Anchorage and wherever? The idea has been around for a long time. Recently what's happened is Alaska Village Electric Cooperative has taken the idea, working with a company called Marsh Creek, and there's some competent engineering types that have worked on it, dusted off the plans, and it's feasible using a high voltage, new technology transmission system that you could do this. But a lot of people are beginning to think that maybe if you did it, what would you do at the other end? It's premised
on where would the other end be? Here,
well,
Fairbanks?
It would be first in Fairbanks, and then it would come down to Anchorage. Then the concept is eventually you could build it out to some of the villages and rural areas. But it's also premised it would require a large power plant, a lot of power demand, much more than we use now. It's premised on converting our homes to electric, which sounds good, except that it could cost $12,000 to $18,000 and all the conversion. Some of the utilities say that it would require major modifications of Chugach's transmission system to handle that much load. So an idea that is worth looking at, maybe taking it to the next step to see if it might be feasible. You could accomplish some of the same thing if you had a gas pipeline that came down to the interior and a large power plant that shipped power out to some of the villages.
Do they have any estimate of how many industrial and, I guess, home consumers they would need to make this work?
Or a mix of them?
Very
preliminary numbers, Michael. It would take some money to put together a more comprehensive plan. And that's what they're asking for, is the legislature to pony up some money to have them do a more advanced conceptual study of it.
Is there any way to tell somebody who lives in Fairbanks or Stevens Village, if we get this, your power bill for the month of January is apt to be some figure?
Well, they have some numbers, but it's very conceptual, and it would be a substantial reduction compared with heating oil is what people are paying for now. But there's so many other loose problems with it that need to be looked at. So I think it's very early to say that this is really something that might be viable.
Steve McDonald.
It's just kind of funny. In the early 80s, electric heat was very expensive. And so many people, including our family, we changed our home from electric baseboard heating to a gas furnace to heat the home because it was so much cheaper to do. And now it's just like kind of flipped around. We're going to take natural gas and generate cheaper electric power.
The idea is also premised on the fact that there will never be a gas pipeline. So we have to wait and see if that happens. Maybe if that's true, maybe we should look at something like this. And I would point out that in southeast Alaska, where there is cheap hydropower, that there are a lot of home conversions to electric going on. A lot of communities are converting, homes and businesses are converting to electric.
They're getting it off the dams of southeast?
Yeah, so much so that they're approaching the capacity of the dams. And now the utilities there have a dilemma. In some communities, they need to build more hydro.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Tim Bradner. Steve, former State Senator Al Adams, dies at age 70. It's quite a large turnout for his funeral here in Anchorage this week.
Yeah, this is one of Alaska's iconic lawmakers. He had spent about 19 years in the House and the Senate combined, born in Kotzebue, just a very powerful, a strong leader for rural Alaska, and he was one of those who would reach across the aisle and actually strive for compromises on certain pieces of legislation. Co-leader of the Finance Committee at one point in time during his career, so he held some very powerful positions as well. So there was a remark about how many different, how many lawmakers from both sides of the aisle turned out at his memorial service. There were, I don't know how many governors, former governors, who were at his memorial service, just kind of a testament to the kind of person that he was, the kind of leader he was, the kind of man that he was as well.
Okay. I'm going to note here that former legislator, House member Mike Byrne, died this week at age 86 in California. Mike Byrne was a very interesting man. He was the author of the Byrne Homestead Initiative, and that his name became synonymous with providing homesteads for Alaskans. This was a ballot proposition that the Byrne Homestead Initiative, that he was the father of. And this took Alaska by storm, I think my colleagues will remember, as people just couldn't wait to get out there and homestead Alaska the way their grandfathers or great-grandfathers had homesteaded Oklahoma, Kansas, or the other states of the 48. Unfortunately, from his perspective, the Supreme Court decided that this was an improper initiative, that it was, correct me if I'm wrong here, Tim, it was an appropriation through the initiative process.
That's right.
And that was illegitimate, so it was shot down. But it's one of those things that's so interesting that at one time, what a big subject this was, how it gripped Alaska, and when it went away, they never were able to re-achieve reignite the spark for homesteads.
Tim? Mike, one thing you could add to that, though, was that this public support for that initiative did spawn legislation that created we do have a state home sales land, rural land program, including a lottery program, and that came out of that.
Through legislation,
the interest and the support from the public that initiative spawned created the environment that led to those bills being passed. And we have those programs today.
Good idea that you brought that up and reminded us of that. Tim, I'm going to stick with you this week and next week. Two major sessions will be on the future of the Arctic will be held here in Anchorage by important organizations. Why don't you tell us about these two groups and what they're going to be talking about?
Well, there are two sets of functions going on. This week, the Institute of the North, which is a longstanding local group, has been sponsoring a kind of Week of the Arctic series of seminars and conferences spanning several days, but probably one of the most interesting days was Tuesday, in which there was an all-day meeting of the Arctic Council. And this is the organization of the nine Arctic nations, of which the U.S. is one by virtue of Alaska, Canada, Norway, Russia, I think Iceland. The UK is an observer member. They have a person who sits in as an observer status. And a lot of the business this week was ministerial, doing some business, setting up some provisions for staffing and things like that. But the next 2 years, Canada will have the chairmanship of it. And the year after that is the U.S. turn. So we're going to have 4 years of North American chairmanship of the Arctic Council, setting things like search and rescue provisions, environmental protections, intercoordination of policies, and things like that, having to do with the Arctic. And there's intense focus of a lot of interest in the Arctic these days with the opening up of the waters and tourism and oil development and things like that. Military concerns.
Shipping.
Security.
We have still have some time. I'm going to turn to Paul Jenkins here. Paul, we're not only reporters, journalists, but we're also members of the community. And as members of the community, we have people going door to door who are running for office, coming to our houses, and we get mail at home from candidates. My impression is the visits, the mail, it's really down this year, reflecting an election where candidates are not spending a lot of money, and it's just there's not the big items without somebody for the governor or the Senate on the bill.
I noticed in my own mailbox that there seem to be fewer and fewer mailers. I used to get three and four at a time from the same guy, Yeah. And I've been home in the afternoons here this last couple of weeks. I think I've actually seen a slight increase in the number of people going around hanging things on doorknobs and whatnot. But as far as candidates, you don't see very many candidates. No.
Steve, obviously you're not involved in the business decisions that go on at your television station, but you probably see more television than the rest of us. Because your work, are we getting those regular ads on television, or is it the Pebble Mine? That's mostly what I see.
Yeah, it's the Pebble Mine, I think.
Which is not on the ballot, we need to remind people.
Right, it's not on the ballot, right. There's a few candidates out there who are advertising right now. I think right now we're still in the summer mode. Alaskans are still playing outside. We're getting ready to send the kids off back to school. So there's a lot of stuff on our plates right now. Our attention is diverted in other places. So I think it's difficult for candidates to corral people in and get that audience going, I think. This is a real tough time to have for August primary candidates. Maybe as we get closer, I'm sure you're going to see things ratchet up a little bit. The kids will have been in school for about a week or so, and maybe things will calm down a little bit more. I think you probably see more door-to-door campaigning, simply because that's probably the most effective way to do it if you're a House candidate. Senate candidates, they've got two districts that they have to go to. It's a little more cumbersome for them. But I think going door to door is probably the most effective way to campaign. But it's a difficult time for candidates to get people's attention.
I talked to one Senate candidate who told me he'd been to 4,000 homes. Mm. I said, "When did you start?" He said, "Last year."
Yeah, it's an ongoing
process. Tim,
any
quick thoughts on, are they coming to your door?
I haven't really noticed them so much in my neighborhood, but also just observation is it's a primary election, sort of low interest, low turnout. I think with the president on the ballot in November, there'll be a lot
more interest. Turnout in the Wisconsin primary earlier this week was about 17%. Mm. We're going to do better than that, but we got to get out of here. Thank you for joining us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.